And the next matter on our calendar is file A210824. It's the second of three, by the way, oral matters. We had a fourth that is rescheduled, and then we have two non-oral matters on our calendar today. And this is State of Minnesota versus Gail Lynn Schauer. As I mentioned, A210824 is the file number, and as counsel settle into your seats, the usual process will occur. Appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes, as will respondent following that, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant's counsel. We do ask that you identify yourselves for the record as you begin your comments, and you'll note that the of the three podiums, the middle one, the traditional one, has the light and the up and down button as well, so it's a little more convenient in that sense, but feel free to choose which you desire. And appellant's counsel's approach, so you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Faison Sessoms. I represent the appellant, Gail Lynn Schauer. And we are asking this court to reverse her conviction and vacate her guilty plea because no one, not the judge, not the prosecutor, not the defense attorney, did their job in the district court. It was a simple guilty plea where my client, to her detriment, found that no one protected her interest. And as a result, Ms. Schauer did not get the plea bargain that she bargained for, that she contracted for. Ms. Schauer was charged with criminal vehicular homicide, and she reached a plea agreement with the state. The plea agreement was that in exchange for her guilty plea to criminal vehicular homicide, the state would not seek an executed guideline sentence of 48 months. Instead, the executed sentence would be stayed for a period of 5 years, and the defendant would serve 365 days in the Scott County Jail with work release.
There was no can I ask you, it strikes me as a bit strong to say no one protected her interest. You just described what I would say objectively is a favorable plea agreement to your client given the presumptive sentence. And so would you agree that's a, we're just narrowly focusing on that one portion of that many terms, but of which is, we would, I assume also all agree, is generally lower down on the importance factor of a plea agreement being the direct consequence of prison versus a stayed probationary sentence.
I agree that she received a departure from the sentencing guidelines.
And you realize if we remand this case, she's not guaranteed that deal again.
That is correct.
And so she runs the risk of an executed prison sentence.
That is correct.
And she acknowledged, and her attorney acknowledged, that the state had a very strong case against her, right?
The inexperienced attorney did, yes.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Is it correct that the complaint here is that she was unable to serve about 6 weeks of her one-year sentence on work release, and that's the claim here?
45 days.
45 correct. Days.
Yes.
Okay.
She bargained. The bargain was, and it's a direct consequence of her plea. The bargain was that she
How
would,
is it a direct consequence? It seems like a collateral consequence because you have here a situation where all the parties seem to acknowledge that work release, it's if eligible. It's not something that is guaranteed, so it doesn't flow directly from the sentence. If it's only available if eligible, that means there's no guarantee that the person will actually get work release then, correct?
Typically speaking, that is correct, but that's not what occurred
okay,
in this
so
case.
Then why isn't that a collateral consequence then?
Because if it relates directly to punishment.
How is work release a punishment? Isn't that a privilege that somebody gets in lieu of having to go to prison?
When she negotiated the plea, she negotiated a one-year sentence with work release. How she was going to serve?
I understand that, counsel. That's not the question. Isn't work release a privilege?
You have to qualify for the program. Here she's being offered a program that did not exist. Okay?
Oh, it existed. It was just suspended for a period of time because of a global pandemic.
Yes, that is correct. But she did not know that.
She didn't know that there was a global pandemic and that things were not operating as usual during that time?
She did not know that work release at Scott County Jail was not available at the time of her plea. Her attorney testified that he guaranteed that she would be receiving work release. He did not know at the time of the plea that work release was not available. And yet the prosecutor made that promise knowing, and he testified that he knew it was not available when he made the offer. So here we have a situation where a prosecutor is making a promise that he knows cannot be fulfilled. It's an unfulfilled or unfillable promise. And he knew it. He knew it.
How does it matter if it's a I want to come back to the collateral issue, because I think that even if we were to accept your argument, it doesn't really matter if it's collateral. Can you cite to any case law stating that work release is a direct consequence versus a collateral consequence?
Well, Judge, the case law indicates that a collateral consequence is one that is civil in nature. Here she was bargaining for the terms of her imprisonment. And when it relates to the type and amount of punishment you're going to receive, then I submit that is, in fact, a direct consequence of the plea. Plus, it's a part of the plea agreement. Most collateral consequence cases involve, like, deportation, where the person hasn't been told about some civil or regulatory consequence that they're going to be facing. But he or she was negotiating to be allowed to work throughout her entire sentence.
How do we get around Bell, which we decided last year, which holds that prison sentence with supervised release is a collateral consequence of a plea?
Well, I think in Bell, and, you know, I'm talking off the top of my head, so I can't really...
I mean, it's a precedential opinion from our court issued last year. A collateral consequence of a guilty plea for purposes of assessing the intelligence of the plea are those that do not punish, serve a substantially different purpose than to punish, and are imposed in the interest of public safety.
Right. And what we're saying is that the work release term is in fact a direct consequence because it was bargained for as the type of punishment she would receive. It's not a civil or regulatory matter. And to offer a program that doesn't exist, knowing that it doesn't exist, making it a part of the plea agreement, seems to me to be prosecutorial misconduct in this case.
How does it get to be prosecutorial misconduct, though? Because isn't really what, if anything, it would be what she had been advised by her attorney versus what the prosecutor is now representing her. And so it's her attorney that has to. And that goes to my next question in terms of your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Under the second prong, you have to show, you know, harm or prejudice. Where is that harm or prejudice when her argument was that she lost she didn't want to lose her job. She didn't want to lose her insurance. She didn't want to lose her benefits. And she wanted to participate in work release. She was able to retain all those, right? She was able to retain her employment, her benefits, her insurance, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so where's the prejudice under the Strickland second prong?
The prejudice was that she did 45 days of straight time where she wasn't able to work, and she lost $12,000 approximately. And there's a substantial, I would submit that there's a substantial difference between a negotiated sentence that says you're going to receive 365 days with work release versus 365 days straight time where you can't work.
What if she didn't have a job that qualified her for work release?
Well, she,
I mean, would that be a collateral consequence, or would it be a direct consequence of the plea?
She would know that she wouldn't qualify. We wouldn't have a problem here because there wouldn't be any work release for her. I mean, she was working. She expected to receive 365 days of work release. That's what she was told at the time of the plea. It wasn't knowing, intelligent, or voluntary.
Now, Mr. Sessoms, you keep referring to negotiated, and that, too, strikes me from this record and the district court's findings to also be a bit strong phrase, because typically we think of the negotiation, and this is how I started out with that first question, is prison versus probation stayed sentence. I mean, that's really the key almost always. And you referenced the plea petition, and of course there's provisions like a PSI and probation and that sort of thing. Those are in that same paragraph where the work service is, and you use the phrase negotiation. I'm fairly confident they weren't negotiating over probation or its terms or the fact it's going to be a part of it. It just is. And so when you add that to the fact that as strongly as you're describing it, I would have expected, and I think the court made a finding to this regard, that at sentencing, when it was clear by then she did know, Your Honor, there's something wrong here. You know, I'm being told now that I can't do work release, and that was a critical part. Would it be a fair reading of the court's order that she just did not find it to be, as you're describing, a critical piece, even if we set aside the collateral, which, by the way, it strikes me also as collateral, but even if it was a direct consequence bargain, that it was not really a critical piece of the agreement?
Well, I think that it was to her, Judge, because she...
No, I understand, but we were just reviewing the district court's order and the findings, which seem to be supported by the record. She's now saying that, of course, and her friend said it, and the court found that incredible.
But the court did find that it was a relevant factor in the plea. It's in her findings of fact. So if it's a relevant factor in inducing the plea, then it's
But
not,
the court didn't find that induced her plea. Am I correct about that?
Well, but
in fact, she said just the opposite.
Well, the case law is that it doesn't have to be a deal breaker. It just has to be a part of the consideration for the plea. And the court found that it was a relevant factor, just not as much as she claims, okay? She found that the defendant was not credible when she said it was a deal breaker. But it doesn't have to be a deal breaker to justify a reversal for it not being a knowing, intelligent, or voluntary plea. It just has to be a factor in the decision. And here, where we have her actively misled by the prosecution, who knew that that particular program wasn't available, even though the defense attorney thought it was, seems to me we've got an involuntary, unintelligent, unknowing plea. And so she's entitled to have it vacated.
But she didn't ask for that at sentencing, though.
Well, that gets into the ineffective assistance problem. Because you would think, as the court suggested, that when the court fails to follow the plea agreement, that the attorney...
Can I stop you there? How did the district court fail to follow the plea agreement?
Sure.
I'm really struggling with that one in
particular. Okay, I understand. On April 16th, work release still wasn't available the day of sentencing, okay? It still wasn't. It didn't become available until June the 14th, but back at sentencing, no one knew when it was exactly going to start. Now,
so that goes to the point of if eligible.
No, Your Honor, because I think that what's happened here is that she was promised a program that didn't exist. It wasn't
That's where I'm struggling with your argument. I fail to see how she was promised a program, because there are any number of things that could have prevented her from being eligible for that. And everybody seemed to understand, and she was even told by her attorney, this is qualified. It's only if eligible. So there are any number of things that could have, it could have been, on her end, it could have been on the, work release program end. And so I'm really struggling with how do you get over that if eligible part. It seems to be a significant qualification.
Sure, except that at the time of the plea, she wasn't told that. She was told it was automatic or guaranteed, okay? And the plea agreement itself doesn't say anything about eligibility. She's a layperson. She's never been in jail or prison. She had no idea, whether or not it's if eligible or not. Her attorney did not explain that to her. The prosecutor misled her by saying, you know, you'll get 365 days of work with work release, period. There was no contingency of if eligible. Now, in December, she found out that the work release program wasn't available, so she contacted her lawyer and said, hey, what are we gonna do? And all the attorney did was wait until the day of sentencing, and instead of saying to the court, hey, we've got a problem, either you have to delay it or we have to follow the procedure, Rule 15, to give her the opportunity to see if she wants to affirm her plea. That never happened. So the district court, which under the rules, when they modify a plea agreement, which is what happened here, they have to give her that opportunity. They never did that.
How did the district court modify the plea agreement?
The plea agreement calls for 365 days with work release. That was the deal. Come sentencing, the defense attorney says, hey, please continue it until work release becomes available. He failed to point out to the judge it's a part of the plea agreement. Mr. Strait, who made the unqualified promise, objected to any further delay. And so here we are today, because she didn't get the deal that she was promised.
Thank you, counsel. And your allotted time has expired.
Yes, I see that. Thank you.
Very well. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself, and then proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. Three issues have essentially been raised to this court, and it's important to put those in the proper standard of review. It's not done in appellant's brief. It is done in the state's brief. The first sort of category of issue is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. The second is prosecutorial misconduct. That is unobjected to prosecutorial misconduct as laid out in the state's brief. So they have to meet all of the four plain error factors for plain error review in that issue. That's the second. And then the third is, of course, ineffective assistance of counsel, which has its also two prongs that they have to establish. So with that, as to the collateral consequence, the district court correctly and accurately quoted and followed this court's decision in Bell. It's a collateral consequence. The attorneys at the post-conviction hearing testified, both Kloss and the prosecutor, that it is always if eligible. The district court found that both Ms. Schauer and her best friend were not credible, that the most important thing to Ms. Schauer is the most important thing often to people is the lowest possible sentence. That's what mattered to her, and that's number one. And so when the district court finds that she's not credible, the district court is putting it in that context. The defense repeatedly says here that the work release program did not exist. That's not the record, and that's not the truth. It did exist. It was stopped for a period of time during the COVID pandemic. It was restarted as soon as it could be. Ms. Schauer was in it as soon as she was eligible, and she wouldn't have otherwise been eligible had she not reached the plea agreement she did.
Can you explain that? Is that because of it was a person crime, and there's a rule that work release is not otherwise allowed, and so that's why the judge had to amend the sentencing order once it was reopened in order to make her available, and that was consistent, as you described it, with the terms of the agreement. So if it had been silent, for instance, about work release.
Well, for two reasons, Judge. First, she wouldn't have had a downward departure without a prosecutor agreement. She would have been in prison where there is no work release. Second, yes, it's the jail policy that this is a person crime, so it would be excluded from the work release policy.
So the point, though, you just stated this, it was part of the agreement. And absent that part of the agreement, the judge would not have issued that amended order to make her available if it was silent, for instance, literally.
Correct.
Okay.
Can you help me? I think the argument is that this case is distinct from Bell and other cases finding that terms of sentences are collateral consequences because this was an agreed-upon disposition. Can you just speak to that argument, please?
To the extent that it's an agreed-upon disposition, it's always the terms of the plea agreement, at least initially, are always if eligible. So work release, if eligible.
But that wasn't stated on the record, and it's not in the plea petition.
That's correct, but it wasn't then stated when work release was not included, and this is what the district court found important and ultimately found that she wasn't being truthful when she was saying that really work release is the most important thing because she would have said something when it wasn't included in the actual sentencing, in the actual plea. With Judge Wilton said, hey, there's no stupid questions here in courtroom three. Do you have any questions at all for me? No questions. Same at sentencing. They knew at sentencing. Unquestionably, everybody knew at sentencing. She said nothing. Any questions? Any concerns? None. So the record supports what the district court found. Unless there are any other questions on any of the other issues.
There seems to be a bit of a factual dispute about when the prosecutor knew it. Is it clear to say the prosecutor knew the rule as of the plea agreement date? Knew the work release was suspended as of the time they were negotiating the agreement and it was entered on the record?
Sure. To the extent it's helpful, I took the time this morning to go through timeline. So the stipulation from the post-conviction hearing was that work release stopped on March 16th of 2020. The prosecutor sent a letter with the offer to Attorney Kloss on September 24th of 2020. In October of 2020, the prosecutor learned that work release was temporarily stopped. That comes from testimony at the hearing. On October 12th or so, the offer was placed on the record. On October 16th, Attorney Kloss emailed the prosecutor stating that he was looking into work release. And then on October 29th was the plea hearing. In December of 2020, the PSI occurred. On October 16th of 21, the sentencing occurred. October 21st was the shower email to Kloss about work release. And then on June 14th, work release was restarted, and Schauer was back into work release in June of 2021.
What does that stipulated fact mean? Defense counsel was looking into work release.
That was not a stipulated fact. That actually was the only stipulation was when work release was stopped.
I see.
And when it was restarted. That came from the testimony both from Attorney Kloss and from Attorney Strait, that they had an email conversation about the fact that work release was stopped in Scott County, as it was in Hennepin County, as it was in Steele County, as it was everywhere. So Attorney Kloss had at least that two-week period where he was going between that email and when they showed up for the plea where he was going to look into it. And he doesn't remember if he did. Timing-wise, does that answer all the questions?
Well, so it does sound like, though, that the prosecutor did know and didn't inform defense counsel, but there's no explanation of why the prosecutor did not?
The prosecutor did inform defense counsel, so the testimony from both the prosecutor and the defense attorney is that they discussed that work release might be unavailable in Scott County and that the defense attorney, Kloss, was going to look into it for his client. Now, the defense has suggested that the prosecutor should have talked to his client directly somehow, which obviously is completely inappropriate. So all the prosecutor can do is talk to the defense attorney, and that's what he did. And then all the judge can do, frankly, is ask, are there any questions? No questions, no concerns? Okay.
What about the argument that the district court basically modified the plea agreement, knowing that it wasn't, that work release was not available at that time?
Work release was not available at that time. Was only available because of the agreement of the prosecutor for the downward departure. Otherwise, they were looking at the prison commit with no work release of any kind. So the district court accepted the plea as it was placed on the record. The district court then later amended and allowed them the work release, issued the order pursuant to the request, no objection from the state, and the defense was on, the defendant was on work release again almost immediately. So the record supports the district court finding that there was never an amendment of the plea agreement. And in any case, if you, in the state's brief, number one, the defense never raised that objection, so they've waived that. They can't raise that for the first time on appeal. Number two, even if you do reach it, there was no amendment to the agreement.
And you're talking about the district court amending, the argument that they amended?
Correct.
Okay.
The defense attorney never asked for it. The defense attorney never objected. The defense attorney never claimed that in the district court, specifically Attorney Kloss.
It sounds like from your explanation today, you would not categorize the work release in any event as an unfulfillable promise because it did exist. It was just suspended because of COVID as it was in many other, and it was reinstituted and she received it as soon as it was open.
Yes, correct. I mean, her claim today substantively is this, really. She wants to withdraw her plea for two reasons. One, the district court didn't follow the agreement and give her the first 45 days of work release, and work release is the single most important thing to her. Two, she doesn't feel very guilty anymore. Those are the two reasons she gave. The first one, and I'm not making, that's the transcript. I have the cites. The first reason we've addressed, and the second reason isn't a sufficient basis to withdraw a plea. So I would ask this court to affirm the district court in all respects, unless you have any questions on any other issues.
Appears there are none. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would disagree with some of the factual characteristics of counsel, because, and I urge the court to carefully examine the post-conviction hearing transcript, because the post-conviction transcript, the district court judge found Mr. Kloss to be credible, and she found Mr. Strait to be credible. Mr. Kloss testified that at the time of the guilty plea, he assured his client that she would be receiving work release. He also testified he did not know at the time he made that promise that work release was not available. Mr. Strait also testified that at the time of the plea, in October of 2020, he knew that work release was not available.
But the relevance of that is balanced against the credibility findings that the district court issued with respect to your client,
but
that she was not induced to sign, to enter into this plea agreement because of work release. So we give the same deference to that finding of credibility as to the other findings of credibility.
Well, I think you have to accept the credible testimony of both Mr. Strait and Mr. Kloss to set up what actually happened. Now, whether it was as big a factor in inducing the plea, whether it was a deal breaker, as the court found it was not, isn't the proper inquiry. The improper inquiry is whether it's a factor
I mean, sure, it's a proper inquiry. You're claiming that it was an unfulfillable promise.
That's
and an
correct.
Unfulfillable promise requires that the promise actually cause the inducement to enter into the agreement.
Has to be a factor in the
agreement. Not a factor. It has to be the inducement. I mean, that's what Bell says.
Well, Your Honor, I believed that.
When a plea rests in any significant degree on a promise or agreement so that it can be said to be part of the inducement or consideration, such promise must be fulfilled. And the district court found that it was not a significant part of the agreement.
She found that it was not a deal breaker.
Part of the agreement.
Well, she found it was a relevant part of the agreement. So, and I don't know that you're bound by the legal conclusion, because you can look at the undisputed testimony of both Mr. Kloss and Mr. Strait as to how this played out. And then you have to decide, well, is her plea knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
What is our standard of review here?
Abuse of discretion.
of which court?
The district court.
The post-conviction court?
Yes.
Okay, it sounds like you're asking us to step in the shoes of the post-conviction court and weigh the evidence and testimony, but that's not our role. We're just an error-correcting court, and so we're looking at whether or not the post-conviction court abused its discretion in its determination. I think that was implicit in the state's argument, but where are you saying that the post-conviction court abused its discretion then?
The court abused its discretion in not allowing her to vacate her plea, and because it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. If the court finds that a plea is not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
But the post-conviction court did find that it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
And that's a legal conclusion based upon the facts that they find.
Okay, so where did the post-conviction court's finding, where are the findings are, where are the post-conviction court's findings clearly erroneous and not supported by the record? Because we just looked to see whether or not the post-conviction court abuses discretion and whether the record supports it, not step into its shoes and start weighing the evidence and the credibility, and we give great deference to the credibility determinations as well.
Sure, and I think with the credibility determinations that she made as regard to Mr. Klaus and Mr. Strait, that it does constitute an abuse of discretion not to vacate this plea because of what my client was told at the time of the plea by both the...
But the post-conviction court looked at that.
I understand, and we're saying that she abused its discretion in reaching a different conclusion.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What I'm saying is that the district court abused its discretion in refusing to vacate the plea because of what happened. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing in the matter and your answers to our questions. We will now take the matter under advisement. We'll issue an order within 90 days. Have a good day.